Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.
Sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Today I have the pleasure of having two authors of a book called Destination Daily, Countdown to Kennedy's Conspiracy. Dave and Lisa is on the line. If you'd like to ask them a question about their book that they wrote, please call in at 347-324-3460, 347-324-3460, or you can pose a question in the chat room. Or you can go ahead and Twitter me at #ApplesCapital. Well, welcome to the program, Dave and Lisa.
Thanks, Tim.
Okay, great.
To be here.
Thanks, Tim.
You know, the fascination, I'm in the Dallas area, and it's kind of gave Dallas, I guess, during that time. You know, things have gone, you know, pretty quiet since then, since the 60s, but now, we're the city that's known for an assassination of a president, which is very rare. And when I saw your information about your book, I said, well, let me get your guys' opinion about that and kind of explore your book. So if you don't mind, kind of tell us what inspired you guys to write this book.
Well, first of all, the Kennedy assassination is just so fascinating to everyone. Anytime the topic comes up, everybody has an opinion on what happened on that day in Dallas. And you've got people who think that there was a very large conspiracy. People think there's a small conspiracy. It runs the gamut. But everyone has an opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's amazing because in 1963, most people alive today in 2012 weren't even born then. So it's a topic that just continues to fascinate. The 50th anniversary is coming next year in 2013. Mm-hmm. So I think that the topic is just going to continue to increase, and people are going to pay more and more attention. And over the years, countless TV shows and movies have referenced it or had episodes about it. It's just something that continues to be in the news.
You know, it was kind of amazing. I remember when I was in, I was born in the kind of the mid-60s, so I still know about it, and I still felt it from the people who lived during that particular era. And, you know, slowly, you know, from Lady Bird Johnson just passed away a few years ago. And, you know, it's just secrecy is one of the great things of this last 20th century that still remains a mystery. I mean, even down to, I remember in 97 when Miss Kennedy passed away and they were auctioning all her belongings out, and they had like the Sears catalog of things that she had, and a lot of things that you expect from that particular era wasn't there, part of that collection. I don't know if the family continued to hold on some of those items, but if you saw her catalog, and I just remember to the T in 97 when I was in at Catholic U, this huge catalog of everything she has there, and we flipped through it, and the reason I got it because John Lewis, who was a congressman, I was ironically at his house, and he was showing me. I said, well, are you going to be bidding for something? And he said, well, you know, it depends on how much it is, but it's just amazing. And you know John Lewis, you know, a big civil rights person who worked with Martin Luther King. And it's that same thing with the Martin Luther King and, you know, Kennedy of the presidency and so forth. It's that mystery. And even Dallas today, is a generation that knows it, but another generation is totally clueless. We have the mall dedication there, but if you ask probably a third of Dallas, they say, what? Oh, okay. You know, it's no effect about it. What is your thoughts around the country? Do you think it's a generational thing? The people who were born in the 60s, kind of have a connection with it. The people who were born in the 80s and 90s really are clueless, or the 70s are really clueless. I mean, they really don't have any connection to it. they really care less. What's your opinion about that? Because I'm...
Well, you're right. People who are from the 60s and 70s really know the stories and understand it. But we found that a lot of people today, because we've been on a few college campuses doing book signings and stuff, and the young people today actually know a lot more than you would expect them to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the stories are in the news all the time. And like I said, you know, like we said, we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of everything from the 60s. And this the Kennedy assassination really started the 1960s. You know, before Kennedy, it was the Eisenhower years and the 50s, and, you know, everything was smiley and fine, even though it really wasn't, but people felt that way. And then the turbulent 60s started off with the Kennedy assassination and the whole, was there a conspiracy and is there a lot of secrecy behind it and stuff.
I think the younger generation, too, is more prone to the conspiracy thinking. The younger generation is more likely to not believe that anyone landed on the moon and to strongly believe in a conspiracy. But it definitely resonates more with the older generation. I think we found the connection of people who were there and remember that day. It's just something that is seared into their memory, and a lot of them, they straddle the fence on whether they're conspiracy theorists or not.
Wow. When you wrote this book, I mean, the next year is the 50th anniversary, and I'm sure you guys are going to get a lot more exposure. The events that you wrote your book in here, you said, are they true events? How did you, I guess, do your research and make an opinion on your particular book?
Well, first let me mention that Destination Dealey, Countdown to the Kennedy Conspiracy,
okay,
is listed as fiction. So just get that off the table. But we like to tell our friends that everything in the book is true except the stuff that we made up, being that it's just a fiction book. Because everyone asks that question. But the truth is that we did a tremendous amount of research, and wherever possible, we stuck to the facts. So you're going to find, this is a novel, but you're going to find real people, Jackie Kennedy, John Kennedy, the people involved in 1963 Dallas, from Lee Harvey Oswald to Jack Ruby to Mrs. Payne, who lived with Oswald's wife. All those people are there. And in addition, we have as many facts as possible about those people. And also, from the assassination itself, a lot of the witnesses who were there that day, we actually pulled from their Warren Commission testimony. So some of the words that they say and things that they think are actually things that they said on the stand.
So kind of tell us, kind of give us a history snap point. What happened during that particular day? We know what the facts are, but kind of give us a bridge, a segue into why did he come to Dallas and what happened that day and the people you interviewed. You kind of give us like a snapshot of what happened that particular day from the beginning, if you don't mind, then bring us forward.
Sure.
Well, President Kennedy was coming to Dallas to, drum up support for the 64 election. We're starting to come into the 64 election season. And although he had won Texas, he had lost Dallas, and I think it's Dallas County. So he was actually on a 5-city tour, and Dallas was supposed to be the last stop. And he was, you know, making a lot of speeches and, you know, doing a few motorcades, actually, before he did the fateful motorcade in Dallas. So he arrived in Dallas that morning. They flew in from Fort Worth, thank you, which is a short flight. And he was going through Dallas in an open limo, which is something no president would even think of doing today. And the crowds were really big. There's a lot of video of the crowds, and they were very enthusiastic to see the president and the first lady. And it was, in the limo was the President Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy, his wife, sitting next to him. And in front of them was Governor of Texas Connally and his wife, and then two Secret Service up in the front seats. And they were going through Dallas. They came down Main Street, and they came into Dealey Plaza. They made a left on Houston and then a right on Elm, And that's when the shots were fired. They were going pretty slow, probably around 10 miles an hour. And the whole thing was captured by a home movie camera filmed by this dressmaker from Dallas, Abraham Zapruder. And, well, the Warren Commission concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman shooting alone. He was up on the Texas School Book Depository in the sixth floor shooting out the window, and which today is a museum in Dallas, the sixth floor museum, which is a really great museum. And President Kennedy was hit twice, and he was shot once in the head and once through the throat. And then after the shootings, the motorcade sped along to Parkland Memorial Hospital, where they tried to revive him, but he was pronounced dead.
Wow. And
it was just a total shock because there were so many spectators at the time, and they could see the motorcade go by and the Kennedy go into some sort of distress and pull his arms up by his throat. And they knew something was going on, and they heard the shots ring out, and then all of a sudden, you know, his head jerked backward, and there was a little explosion there, and it was just a terribly traumatic and horrible day for Dallas, really, and for the nation.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So, and your eyewitness accounts, I mean, of course, you said everything was captured on the dressmaker's video camera?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the news media, with all of them out there, they never capture some really good
footage
from
it? That's a good question. I think the news media were really concentrated on the places where he was speaking. So there just didn't happen to be anybody from the news in Dealey Plaza.
In Dealey Plaza.
A lot of the press were actually riding in a bus in the back of the motorcade. So they were concentrated. They were waiting for his next stop, which was going to be
the
Trademark, where he was doing a luncheon speech.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there was really no official film of the assassination. There were several amateur films.
Okay, and that's what the Warren Commission pulled together to try to put the story together, what happened.
Yeah, they pulled
that, and a lot of eyewitnesses.
Eyewitnesses, okay. and photographs and movies. Anything they could get their hands on.
Okay. And with the eyewitnesses themselves, what did they really say? I mean, just like you just mentioned, they heard shots, but they saw him move, but they really didn't know what was going on?
Yeah, they heard shots. I mean, some of them, there was some dispute over how many shots they heard, you know, but it was, the shots were echoing around the plaza. And, you know, like most eyewitnesses, all the stories don't line up perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone has a different angle and everyone has a different opinion and stuff. And there were probably around 100 people in Dealey Plaza, somewhere between 50 and 100 people. This was near the end of the motorcade. They were just about to speed up and get on the highway.
Cemeteryway.
Mm-hmm. And so the crowds were thinning out. So there weren't as many witnesses as there were earlier, you know, many people lining the street as there was earlier in the parade route. So, yeah, but the Warren Commission interviewed everyone they could, so they say.
I mean, some of the people said things that they heard shots coming from the grassy knoll. Well, most people said they heard shots coming from the Texas School Book Depository. There were some wacky stories as well, because it was pandemonium. Things happened so quickly, and it was hard to – something unexpected. And a lot of people either dropped to the ground or ran. They ran up the grassy knoll, in fact, to go back to where their cars were parked behind the railroad tracks over there.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
We also, in terms of witnesses, we also have witnesses who saw Oswald on that day, that morning, his coworker that drove him to work, people in the Texas School Book Depository that he worked with, and then afterwards where Oswald was at work that day, and then he left right after the shooting, and we kind of follow his path through some witnesses and where he went and what he did, which was a little erratic and inexplicable, where he went and what he did afterwards.
So, and while I'm going to say European, some people think he was alone, he did it by himself. Some people don't really believe that he did it by himself. They probably just believe that he was set up, and some people think it was Russia. Some people think it's the people who don't like Catholics, and so forth. In your book, how did you explain the story?
Oh, in our book, well, we don't want to give away the entire story.
Okay.
But we do want to talk about conspiracy theories versus, you know, what we call in the community the lone nut theory. So we've got the lone nutters and the conspiracy theorists. And I'd like to say personally that Oswald acted alone.
Okay.
I would like to differ with that and say that Oswald really wasn't acting alone. I don't think he was. Yeah, no offense to him or his offspring, but I really don't think he was smart enough to pull this off.
Well, with the world the way it was at that particular time, you know, yes, he's a Marine, but, you know, I can't say that, you know, really what happened, but it's just hard to believe one person can take out the President of the United States without any additional help, you know. I don't know. So I'm guessing
exactly.
I'm leaning on to you guys.
I understand what you're saying. I think that's the problem with the whole lone nut theory is that most people don't want to believe that a human zero like Oswald could take out a president.
He was a Marine, right?
He was a Marine.
He was a Marine.
He was a marksman.
Okay.
Yeah, he joined the Marines around age 17 because apparently it was too strict living with his mother, so he thought he'd have more freedom in the Marine Corps. And, you know, all Marines are marksmen. They're all trained to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, intensive training.
Yeah. You know, they're always, Marines are probably one of the, really, I would say, the most loyal armed forces of the United States. I mean, they really, really, yeah, some would have the opinions, but even during that time, they're really, really loyal to the country. Is any of your research, did anything show that he had this animosity against the president or the establishment?
Well, yeah, kind of. I mean, he did. After he left the Marine Corps, he defected and went and lived in the Soviet Union. He renounced his U.S. citizenship, and he lived in Russia in the Soviet Union for 2.5 years. So, yeah, he gave up on capitalism, and he declared himself a Marxist, and he wasn't really a big fan of the United States, really.
I think that he also wanted to gain notoriety for himself. This is a guy who wanted attention. He wanted to be noticed, and he wanted to be remembered in history. I mean, he did some crazy things, some interesting but crazy things in Russia. First of all, he kept a diary of all of his activities, and he wrote a very fascinating piece that he called The Collective, which was on how things work in Russia and what the day-to-day life is like for someone who is a Russian citizen, and it's a fascinating piece of work. But then when he said he would never return, but he in fact did return to the U.S., he expected a press conference. He expected that people were going to take notice of this guy who defected to the USSR. I mean, no one did that sort of thing. So he actually wrote up a list of possible questions, hypothetical questions, and what his answers would be. So this is a person who expected to be greeted by a crowd of, you know,
reporters
and newspapers and everything, and no one really took notice. So I think part of his thing is that he wanted to be famous or infamous. And there's also evidence that he tried to assassinate another political person, General Edwin Walker, earlier that year. So this is a person that just wanted to make a name for himself.
Regardless, even if it ended up in his death, he still wanted to make a name for himself.
Yeah.
Quite possibly.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, but even, you know, if we think about, you know, who shot Lincoln, you know, really people, you know, I say, yeah, he made a name for himself, but you think he was that delusional that I think people really would care? I mean, his name is connected to it, but however, we don't look at him in a positive way. And that's what this whole conspiracy is all about. We just can't believe that one person took out the United States, meaning the president, without any additional help.
Yeah, it is really hard to believe.
And, if he, he's not going to be, I guess, thought of in a good light at the very end. I mean, they can tarnish whatever he was trying to strive for. And of course, he didn't even survive anyway. How long did he last anyway?
How long did he last?
You mean, how long did he live after that?
Only 2 days.
Yeah, 2 days.
Yeah, he was arrested on, the assassination occurred on Friday at about 12:30, and he was arrested a couple hours later. And then 2 days later, when he's being transferred from police headquarters to county jail, he was shot and killed by nightclub owner Jack Ruby. So that's another part of the conspiracy, is that, Oswald was silenced. He never had a chance to tell his story.
And what about Jack Ruby? What happened to him?
Jack Ruby, he was tried for murder,
mm-hmm.
And convicted in Dallas. And he was actually sentenced to death, but his sentence was commuted, and then in 67, I believe it was, he died of cancer while still under appeal. But he was another interesting guy. He was a lifelong bachelor. He owned two nightclubs in Dallas, the Carousel Club, which was a burlesque.
A strip joint, basically.
And something called the Vegas Club, which was a rock and roll club, which I'm not sure what that was exactly like in 1963, what a rock mm-hmm. and roll club was. Ruby had a lot of friends on the law enforcement, but he was definitely a mafia wannabe type.
Okay.
He thought he was a big shot, and he had a really bad temper. He had been arrested a few times for beating people up in his club. He had some anger management issues. And then when he goes and kills Oswald, they were actually going to move Oswald in an armored car to keep people from trying to kill him, because they
mm-hmm.
thought, this guy just, allegedly killed the president. But they couldn't back the armored car up into the basement of the Dallas police headquarters because the doorway was too small. So they had the armored car parked outside of the Dallas police headquarters, and they were going to just walk him up the ramp and out there. And it was a little chaotic. There were reporters all over and TV cameras, and it was being broadcast live on national television on Sunday morning. And Ruby somehow, easily enough, slips in through the crowd and just walks right up to Oswald and shoots him. it seemed as if it was a spur of the moment kind of thing, because Ruby had left his dog in the car, his favorite dog, Sheba, a little mutt. And he was very upset that, Oswald had killed President Kennedy, and he just went nuts. He always had his pistol with him, apparently, and he just went down there and killed him.
Wow.
That was really shocking, too, because that one was caught on live on TV.
Yeah.
I remember my mom saying that she watched it and said to myself, my gosh, I just saw a murder on television live. I mean, that was one that the media was there for, and it was shocking. And Ruby,
wow.
When he was arrested, the thing that he maintained the whole time of why he did it, what he said himself, was that he wanted to spare Mrs. Kennedy the trauma of coming back to Dallas to testify in a trial. So he was trying to spare her that. That's what he officially said to everyone. I mean, I think he just snapped, and he loved his president, and he was really ticked off that Oswald killed Kennedy.
It's kind of ironic. This, after all of this is gone and said, she lived, as a widow, she moved on, and she became internationally known, married this great tycoon, and really laid her second chapter of her life, this huge legacy, and towards the end. Regarding the officer, J.D. Tripp, what was his opinion? You have here in some notes. What did he actually say?
Oh, Officer J.D. Tippett?
Mm-hmm.
everything. He was the officer who was also killed by Oswald that day. Is that the one you're thinking of?
Yes.
Yeah, that he's really the forgotten casualty of November 22nd, 1963, because after the president was assassinated, allegedly by Oswald or by a conspiracy, which we do answer that question in the book. Want to mention that in Destination Daily.
Okay.
It's pretty undisputable that Oswald, in his travels, he took a bus, got stuck in traffic, took a cab, ended up near his rooming house, got a pistol, and then was walking along the street, and police officer J.D. Tippit, who was a war veteran, a family man, married his high school sweetheart, had three young children, stopped Oswald and from his patrol car, possibly, no one really knows why, but possibly because Oswald fit the description that had already been broadcast to the police radio. And some witnesses saw an exchange happen through the passenger window where they spoke, and they both Tippit got out of the car and started to walk around, and Oswald walked around, and without giving it any kind of chance to defend himself, Oswald just shot him point blank on the street.
Wow.
And that's one thing we really emphasize in our novel, and J.D. Tippit is the main character when we get back to 1963, because he's really an unsung hero. Here's a man trying to support his family and protect the public, and he's just brutally murdered in broad daylight in a suburban neighborhood.
So what are the conspiracy theories that's really flown out there?
Oh, well, you know, they really run the gamut from pro-Castro
mafia
supporters to anti-Castro supporters, the CIA, the FBI, Johnson, who becomes president.
He had the most to gain.
He becomes president, although just for a little while. There's if you go to Dealey Plaza and just hang around like on the street corner and listen to people, every single person has a different conspiracy theory almost.
Wow.
I mean,
hey,
there's
just
so many of them.
Well, I think the obvious ones, too, are Johnson, who had the most to gain.
Right.
And, Russia. Kennedy had squared off with Russia on a number of occasions, particularly through the Cuban Missile Crisis, where Kennedy also had a lot of problems with Fidel Castro of Cuba. Kennedy basically tried to have Castro taken out with the Bay of Pigs invasion, which failed. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of years later, Castro let the Russians put missiles on Cuban soil, which would have easily reached the United States. So we were on the brink of nuclear war. So a lot of people really had a grudge against President Kennedy. So it's very easy to point conspiracies. It's fascinating, really. That's why there's so many things that converged on this conspiracy to make it a great topic that we could probably stay on this phone for, a couple of hours talking about.
Yeah, it's just amazing, people that have those many issues during that period of time. And I'm just thinking of, for the past really 30-some-odd years, I mean, everybody had their issues with the president or something like that, but I mean, it's like, this is like one extreme. It's like the conspiracies, I mean, gosh, they really hate this person that much that go to this particular extreme. I mean, I love Reagan. A lot of people didn't like Reagan. I mean, if you look at the other presidents before then, but I've never seen so many, maybe it's that particular time of the moment when we're in the middle of the war and we have all this other stuff that's going on. Maybe things were just totally different, but it's just saying, okay, my gosh, do they really hate this person that much to be this extreme? Because of this living, from the 70s, 80s, 90s up to the present, I mean, we have issues with present, but we really don't, nobody usually, want to kill a person, but however, I mean, guys, a person that's really hating a president that much that the world wants to take him out? Does that make any sense?
It is a little strange. Kennedy won the election by one of the slimmest margins in the 20th century, only about 0.2% of the popular vote, compared to Bush and Gore, where it was 0.5%. It was even closer than that. And the 60s became a very turbulent time with a lot of changes. You know, Vietnam was just starting up, and there was a lot of confrontation with the Russians and with the Cubans, and it was a lot of revolution, you know, and South America had a lot of problems. But it's not so much, and Kennedy actually was very popular during his presidency, especially after the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the Russians backed down basically to him when he stood up to them. But a lot of that is people saying, you know, now saying, oh, you know, the FBI hated him, or, you know, Castro hated him. But there was a real lot of conflict, and it was starting a very a decade with a lot of conflict. The 60s had a lot of conflict in them.
Well, I think there's also two ways of looking at it. I mean, you have, you know, would another leader of another country or another organization take out the president? I mean, I guess it's always possible. We've done that in other countries ourselves, you know, and Kennedy tried to do that with Castro. But then there's also the other side of it. If you're thinking non-conspiracy and you're thinking lone nut, there have been attempts on several presidents since then. I mean, there were attempts made on Ford and Reagan.
Right, Reagan by John Hinckley, who was trying to impress Jody Foster, of all the weird
people. So if you're in the lone nut camp, of course, it's happened before, and they make it very difficult for people to try this these days.
Yeah.
But is it possible for there to be conspiracy where a world leader does something? I think it's definitely possible.
Absolutely. I think if I read something, I think they were going to, at one period, open all the files available to the public. Is that still being planned in the next 3 years?
Well, there were a lot of files and a lot of testimony which were sealed for, they sealed them for 50 years.
50 years.
Or 75 years, depending. So that the people who, you know, made these statements or collected this evidence, you know, are either passed away or at the end of their life. But as far as I know, there's really nothing specifically major that might come out after 50 years, so, you know, 2013 or 2014.
I think that's another issue, too, is that there's actually a ton of information out there. If you look at the official record, there's a ton of information from the Warren Commission. There were 27 volumes and reams of exhibits and testimony, which is really fascinating to read through. But once you start reading through volumes and volumes of information, you can pick up any discrepancy between testimonies or things said or whatever. And it's, with that volume of information, it's very easy to start dreaming up a lot of different conspiracies. So in that sense, it's not surprising that it's of the conspiracy nature of everything coming together on this.
What happened to Oswald's wife?
Well, Oswald's wife, she's fascinating. She was very young when he met her. She was Russian, and he met her when he lived in Russia, and he married her after they only knew each other for about 6 weeks. To me personally, I think this is another way to gain notoriety, that he wanted to be very different and live in Russia and marry a Russian girl, as they were called way back then. but in his historic diary, he claimed that he married her because he wanted to make his other girlfriend jealous. So that's what he said himself in his diary. Well, that maybe that's true. I don't know. But she moved with him back to the U.S., and they actually didn't live together when the president was assassinated. He kept a boarding house and only visited her on weekends. She lived with Mrs. Ruth Payne, who was someone who was practicing her Russian. She was speaking Russian in order to improve East-West relations, which was very kind of a noble thing to do in 1963. So she wasn't really even living with him at the time, but by some accounts, Marina had an inkling, his wife Marina, that he was involved, because when he was shot, when the president was shot, she said, she learned it was from the Texas School Book Depository, she said her heart dropped because she thought maybe it was Lee. So she had an inkling then. But in years since, so she told the truth then, and she told about he kept a rifle in the garage and all those kinds of facts, and that she was aware he had made an attempt on General Walker previously. But she's still alive today, and she ended up remarrying a few years later. She married a man named Porter, and I believe he adopted her two daughters, who were just a baby and an infant when the president was killed. And but now she's kind of, over the years she's changed, and her position is that her former husband was, I don't know if she says, I think she does say now that he was innocent. I've seen a couple of interviews where she thinks he was innocent, and she wants the truth to come out. And I've heard both of his daughters being interviewed as well, and they have the same, you know, they have the same perspective that they think he was innocent, which, you know, whether he is or not, of course, someone's daughter, you can't blame them for wanting to think that.
Absolutely. And J. Edgar Hoover, how does he play a part of this this role?
It's a great question.
It's a great question.
Okay. Yeah, so Hoover was one of the most powerful people in Washington, right? And he was known to keep secret files on everyone. And I mean everyone, political figures, you know, Hollywood actors, civil rights activists. And allegedly, he used to blackmail a lot of people, too, to get them to, I don't know, do whatever he wanted. He was head of the FBI since the FBI started in 1924 until he died. He never retired. He died in 72. And, you know, the FBI did a lot of good. They took down a lot of the gangsters in the 20s and 30s. You know, like John Dillinger and Machine Gun Kelly and stuff, and even had a lot to do with Al Capone being arrested. But he was a very interesting person. He definitely held grudges against people, and he didn't like a lot of people, and he wasn't above blackmailing people and doing secret surveillance. I mean, he was all over the place, this guy. And, He wasn't that, you know, Kennedy, John F. Kennedy was his boss, and John F. Kennedy's brother Robert was the Attorney General, who was Hoover's direct boss. And they did have a lot of conflict between them. You know, Robert Kennedy was big on going after organized crime, especially within trade unions, which may or may not been prevalent at the time, and especially Jimmy Hoffa, who was head of the Teamsters, and many people feel was very crooked at the time. And the Kennedys and the Hoffas clashed a lot, and it's debatable. Hoover probably didn't like that, because in theory, Hoover knew a lot about Hoffa and his dealings and stuff, but a lot of people think that Hoover had Hoffa in his pocket.
He was seen to be soft on organized crime, Hoover.
Yeah.
So there's definitely some conflict.
Wow, but he was tough on everything else.
What?
It was tough on everything else.
Yeah.
That's really the theory, though, is that he wasn't as hard on the mafia as he was on other areas.
Yeah.
Do you think because of is the simple economics, they did run businesses. I mean, it was a business to itself. So, what was anybody knew? What was the reason why he didn't really clamp down on organized crime?
No, not really. And you know, then they ran a lot of businesses and they ran a lot of the unions, in theory. But no one's really sure, because most of Hoover's private secret files were destroyed after he died in 72. So there's not really a lot of evidence as to exactly what was going on.
Okay. Any other comments you'd like to talk about your book and how we can find your book, and any other comments you want to make about it?
Oh, sure. Well, we definitely want to tell people where they can find it. The book, again, is called Destination Dealey, Countdown to the Kennedy Conspiracy. And, of course, Dealey being the reference to Dealey Plaza, where the president was assassinated, sadly. But our website is www.destinationdealey.com, and Dealey is spelled with an L-E-Y. It's available from all the major book retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iBooks.
iTunes.
And you can find out a lot more about it on our website, which is destinationdelia.com. Again, it's fiction. It's a novel. So it does take all of these facts and spin it into quite an interesting conspiracy story, which involves some people from the present going back to the past then affecting a change. So we think it's pretty exciting. We do have some humor in there and a lot of interesting facts and, like we said, witnesses. So we're hoping that your listeners are going to check us out at destinationdelia.com. I think I've plugged enough. Dave, do you have anything else to say?
No, I think you've plugged plenty.
And well, how do you market the book itself? I mean, are you self-published or are you published through a publishing house?
Oh, we have a publishing house. It's Ursa Minor Publishing. They're a small publishing house. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, we do most of the promotion ourselves. And how do we market? Well, we have a fairly large web presence. Right, we have our website, destinationdelia.com. We're on Facebook. We have a blog at ldcfitzgerald.com.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter.
Yeah.
Of course. All the major players.
All the major things. And the big book reading sites like
Goodreads
and Shelfari and stuff. And we're in all the social bookmarking sites like StumbleUpon. And we're all over.
We're all over the internet. We're also doing book signings. We recently did a book signing at Lehigh University, which is where a small portion of the book takes place. So that
mm-hmm.
was really kind of fun. There's an exciting chase scene through that campus. We're planning a few more in the future. Gosh, we're doing so many things. It's hard to even remember.
And we're doing your great show.
Yes, we're doing your great show.
Okay, great. Thank you. Now, for example, I talked to a couple of authors. Is it really easy for, you know, places like to get in? And Barnes & Noble is probably difficult because they tied into the majors. What about places like, I'm sure independents are really open for you to go do things with them, but places like Half Price Books, do they, for authors like you, or is it really easy to go and do book signings with them?
It helps to have some kind of tie-in with them. Like I said, with
okay.
the one we did at Lehigh, we had a tie-in there, and we're working on some locally as well. It is hard unless you know someone or you have some way to connect yourself with that area or that bookstore. We're also looking at doing some functions that would be at some other locations that are mentioned in our book. There's a couple places in New Jersey and Pennsylvania that are mentioned, and we're hoping to do, like, there's a believe it or not, a small brewery in New Jersey that was mentioned, so we're hoping to connect with them. But we do have a presence at all the online bookstores. I just want to make that clear. We might not be in every, you know, we're not going to be down the street at your bookstore necessarily, but we are online in just about every place that you might
So be. Online is, of course, like Barnes & Noble's and Amazon. Any other big name or name online if they want to shop around?
Oh, sure. I can't think of all the names offhand, but...
yeah, we're in the Apple.
Right, but other bookstores. I'm drawing a blank, but yes, pretty much all of the online, any place you can find books online, you're probably going to find us, or they can order it.
Okay.
It shouldn't be a problem.
Anything you're working on after this book?
Yes, actually. We're currently working on a couple of books that are definitely related to the Kennedy assassination. These will be more, surprisingly, in the nonfiction arena. I'm putting together a whole set of work on Lee Harvey Oswald and everything that he wrote. I was mentioning before, he wrote volumes of things when he was in Russia and before and after, and I'm compiling it all together and putting some analysis around it, so it should be a fascinating read. And Dave is, in the meantime, working on a whole list of Kennedy speeches and writings. So there's a good, rich source of information there on Kennedy. So these are going to be sort of companion books to Destination Dealey, and we hope to be publishing them in the next few months. So that'll be
wow.
on our website as well.
Well, great. Congratulations on that. And you guys work as a team.
We do.
Yes.
Well, it's a lot easier. So how do you actually artistically come with these ideas? You just sit at the table and say, hey, this is an idea for this particular book. How does inspiration come to you?
Well, generally, I do most of the work, and
something like that.
Everything really is a collaboration, but in terms of writing, it was very difficult because we each had ideas and we had to debate them and see what would come out the best. But the original idea for the novel was Dave's.
Wow.
Do you want to elaborate, Dave?
Yeah, we had rented a bad B movie, not bad, a B movie from 2000 called Time Quest, where this guy goes back to save President Kennedy. And it was really independent and inexpensively made. We just rented it because we like time travel movies, and Bruce Campbell was in it, and we like Bruce Campbell. And we had been looking for a book idea, and I thought this was a great book idea, but my original idea was to go back and kill Kennedy, but that didn't really... It's not very heroic, so...
He wanted to do the opposite and say, let's go back and kill Kennedy. So, well, that's a great idea, but maybe people wouldn't be too sympathetic to the characters.
Yeah.
So we have kind of a twist on that.
Wow.
Yeah. Our book actually, if I can give something away, involves that the first time around, Jackie Kennedy was killed. So people want to fix that. So if that will intrigue people. So this group of people has to go back and fix time to make sure that doesn't happen.
Right.
Things might go awry, though.
Well, I really appreciate you guys coming on to the show. This has been fun. You know, another take on the Kennedy assassination. But again, to get your book, you go to your website, and just go repeat your website address again.
Yes, it's www.destinationdealey.com. Or
okay.
You can also get it at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. And the author name, we're Dave and Lisa, but the author name is LBC Fitzgerald, which that's easy to remember because it was John F. Kennedy's middle name as well.
Wow. Well, thank you guys for coming on the program.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We had a great time.
It's been great.
Thank you. Take care. I really appreciate it.
Bye.
Thank
Bye.
You. Take care. Bye-bye. This has been another production of the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. You can download this episode on iTunes or podcast or blog.applecapitalgroup. Thank you for listening. Have a great day. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For a free quote on equipment leasing and financing, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. And fill out the information to receive your free quote. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to the core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. Thanks again for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.